tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 2nd of January 2016. Welcome to another show. Welcome to another year. Folks, I've got a lot of stuff to run through with you today. But first, I would like to make a short statement to clarify what this radio program is all about and what I am essentially on about. People often ask me why I do what I do, and often with a tone of incredulousness, and often people suggest that it's all rather pointless because you can't really change things. And, you know, this type of criticism is actually quite common. And it's a little surprising when you find that people who know a lot about the world are actually missing a certain very, very important perspective, a certain type of understanding about the world, about the two-way nature of reality. It's not just reality impinging on you. You impinge back on reality. And everything you do changes the world. Every small action or inaction of yours will make a change in the world. Now, of course, what people often mean when they say, you know, why do you bother doing this, is that they feel that the action that we do, the effect that it can have on the world, is so small and so insignificant that it's not worth doing. And this is actually sometimes a difficult argument to counter if you do not remain firmly centered in the understanding of the true nature of the world. You see, the view that we cannot change the world because it's all too big and we are just too small and insignificant to make a difference, that is actually a type of programming. It's fascinating, really, because that programming itself is one of the most powerful forces that keeps people enslaved. Now, there are a number of ways of countering it, but I'm not really here today to address that. I simply want to make it quite clear that you don't have to buy in to that viewpoint. And you can do your own research, do your own thinking, do your own meditation to understand that way of seeing things is a self-limiting proposition. It is actually a lock on your mind. And what I'm trying to do with this show is to free the mind and to break the locks. So every proposition that states with, you know, you can't do this, or there's no point in doing that, or you know, why should we bother, is actually a symptom of a problem. And it's a symptom of a problem that is actually linked to the nature of depression, the nature of a mental illness. And this is actually leading me into what I'm going to talk about with you a little today, because I've just had a chance to watch a pre-release of an excellent documentary made by Kevin P. Miller, a man who's been on this show a number of times, a filmmaker who's made a lot of great films, and two of them are on the subject of psychiatry and mental illness and the necessity for freedom of choice and the necessity for people to become aware of the reality of what psychiatry is doing to people in the name of medicine, in the name of healthcare, in the name of healing. And Kevin's films are generally focused on depression and the medical industry that has been built around depression, and mainly in the form of SSRI medications, although in his film he does go well beyond that and gets into a lot of other areas, even including touching on electroconvulsive therapy, which I've discussed in previous shows. But what I would just want to zero in on here for a moment is that this this problem that psychiatry purportedly is here to deal with, which is the problem of depression. Depression in its manifestation almost always has the aspect of it that people feel completely powerless and completely dwarfed by reality, by life. And a typical description of someone's inner state when they're very depressed is that they feel even the smallest task is just too immensely difficult. And that's actually a parallel to how we all have become in relation to this out of control, malignant presence in our life, which is really the state. It's the government. It's the, you know, we try to find the right words, and I think we're still kind of feeling our way to understand what it is, what this malevolent, overwhelming, destructive, oppressive force is in our life. And it goes by various names, but it's a presence in the modern world. And I'm likening it to, you know, the perception of that is actually the way we feel when we become deeply depressed. And part of being deeply depressed is that we lose our sense of our own volition, of our own agency, and we feel crushed. And so it's a two-way thing. You see, the fact that we feel this way, the fact is actually a projection of reality. Of course, there is the external reality. I'm not denying that. But the projection of our feeling of helplessness is a very, very large part of what makes that external reality real. So to turn it around, we have to awaken and tune in to our agency and our potency and our power. And that will, starting in your own sphere, that will change your reality. Agreed? It won't change what's happening all over the world. It won't change what's happening even in your country or even in your city. But your world is your world. That's your right, your entitlement to walk and talk and think in your own space, not in the space that you feel is kind of your doom or your sentence, that you are somehow thrust into being an individual with no power. You don't have to be in that state, even when you are objectively, from some points of view, an individual who has no power. But it's really not as bad as that, because we do have the power to reach out and communicate. With the advances in communication brought about by the internet, we can, in all kinds of ways, we can make connections that are quite subversive, that are not, they don't make huge ripples on the surface of society, but that actually have a huge amount of impact on that subliminal level to society, we can reach out and touch people. So that's why it is so important to find your own way, to find your own channel, to reach out to communicate. And your life, your perception of your reality will change, and you will touch other people. And at some point, you'll get some feedback from that. At some point, someone will tell you that what you've done or said helped them. And then you know that you've made a difference. So, let me now just continue. I want to talk a little about Kevin P. Miller's new film, Letters from Generation RX. This is Kevin Miller's second film on the topic, and the idea for the film came from many, many letters that he received in the wake of the first film, which was an expose of the psychiatric industry and SSRI drugs and the terrible pain and suffering that they've caused in America and around the world. And there were so many follow-up communications he had from people after doing that film that that several years later he decided to embark on a kind of a sequel. And this film, to me, it's very, very substantial. And I think it's a better film than the first one. I found it much more powerful. It's really well put together. It's beautifully produced. It's actually, I would call it a beautiful film to watch, despite the material being so harrowing. But it is made with a great amount of filmmaker's skill, and I can really see the care and the attention to detail in every scene, in every shot. The camera work, everything about it is really, really beautiful in the way it's been done. And the film really highlights for me that a terrible, terrible crime has been committed on people throughout the world. And the crime has been to release these drugs onto the market under the banner of medicine, with the say-so of supposedly very wise, learned men in white coats who aren't just salesmen. You know, if they were just salesmen, you could say, well, they're just selling a product and we can make a choice. These look like priests. These are people whose authority you're not supposed to question. And we're just going to break. But I will enlighten you more on that when we come back from break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. And just following up on what I was saying there before the break, the way in which psychiatric medications have been foisted upon society is a complete abuse of the trust that people have in the institutions of medicine and government approval mechanisms like the FDA. It is such a betrayal that it suggests that the social contract, the very fabric by which society is held together, is somewhat nullified I mean, so many people in the stories that Kevin Miller outlines have described the way either they themselves or their children, because quite often these stories are actually about children, but the pattern is very common. The patient goes to the doctor sometimes for something that's completely unrelated to mental illness, and they come home with some pills, and these pills are psychiatric medications, sometimes very powerful psychiatric medications, and sometimes they're given a sample set of pills. I mean, there was one case, I think, where one of the people who committed suicide in the film, a teenager, went to the doctor with a chest cold and came home with psychiatric medication. Another girl who hanged herself had anxiety before exams. She had what they call test anxiety. She was put on SSRIs and hanged herself shortly after. But there are just so many cases of it. There are just far too many to even begin to discuss details. But what the common pattern is that people innocently go to the doctor for something that might be minor or it might be major, but they're just putting their trust. And the doctor says, well, just take this pill. And that's it. Just, you know, take your medicine. Here's your medicine. This is what you need. And they're never told what the known risks are. They're never given informed consent about what it is that they're actually ingesting. And this is incredibly common. I'm not exaggerating this in any way. My own mother was put on SSRIs, paroxetine, and she did not know she was on the drugs until I checked her prescriptions. She had no idea she was taking antidepressants. She went to the doctor one day and said, oh, I don't feel well, I'm feeling a bit down. I can only assume something like that. And the doctor just wrote her a prescription, and just she was on SSRIs, and she would have stayed on SSRIs indefinitely. So this is literally what is going on. Now, in a certain proportion of cases, these drugs cause a massive personality change. They cause delusions, psychosis. They cause people to do crazy, crazy things. Admittedly, it's a smaller number, you know, but the risk is so severe that not to inform patients of that risk is just criminally negligent. And the information, and again, this is all provided in Kevin Miller's film, the information had been known to the major drug companies going back to 1983. Yes. 1983. They knew how dangerous these drugs can be. Now, even when the drugs don't cause these massive psychotic outbreaks, they often cause extreme mood disturbances. They often cause hallucinatory effects. They cause all kinds of dysfunction. But that is often then ascribed to depression itself, because people who take the drugs are allegedly suffering from an illness called depression, and so when various adverse events occur, they're often just put down to the fact that, well, this person's depressed, and depressed people have all these types of, you know, problems commonly. The film that Kevin Miller has put out documents the facts that were known from the beginning by the drug industry, and documents the way that some of the big players like GlaxoSmith budgeted for the fines which were inevitably issued against them. Some of the biggest settlements in US history, a $3 billion settlement. but they'd already made $20 billion out of the drug. They knew that there was trouble coming. They budgeted for it. But no one went to jail. It was just a fine. The number of cases that that are outlined in the film that show people suffering massive personality changes and embarking on homicidal rampages is really, really chilling. And it needs to be considered in the context of some of the recent terrorist events which we've seen around the world. I've got an article which I just don't have to my fingertips right now, but which indicated that the bunch of people who went on a killing rampage in Paris recently were on some type of psychiatric meds. And there have been other cases. It's become quite common that that people who engage in acts of extreme violence are found to be on psychiatric medications. And it's a subject that needs deeper investigation. But you know, how do you get people to massacre large numbers of people? Of course, the media will say, well, they did it because they're religious extremists and fanatics. Yes, partly. But that's still, you know, there's certain barriers, there's certain inhibitions that the average person will not cross. But we've seen more and more that these types of mass killings do actually have a psychiatric drug component. And one of the key characteristics of the powerful SSRI drugs is the lowering of inhibitions. And again, this is something that is discussed in a lot of detail in the film, which is that what is actually often perceived as a remission of symptoms of depression is actually a lowering of inhibition. Because part of the feeling of depression is this feeling of inhibition. It's kind of what I was talking about earlier. You feel that you just can't do anything. You feel paralyzed. You feel that it's kind of like there's some sort of overreaction on your part to the world, which is clamping down on your ability to express yourself. And this type of inhibitory mental state is one that is associated with the frontal lobe functions, and it is also very, very important because it is part of morality. It is part of ethics and morality, and cultural inhibitions are very, very important to prevent society from just generating into barbarism. Now, given people who are suffering from depression have a little too much of that going on, but the reasons for that are often very complex. But the drug is not complex. The drug is very blunt and brutal in the way it works. It just floods your synapses with serotonin, and this causes a sudden release of inhibition. We're going to break. I'm talking about Kevin Miller's film Letters from Generation RX. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And just continuing there, as I was saying, the effect of SSRI drugs, one of the effects is release of inhibitions. And in people who have been suicidally depressed, this release of inhibition can actually suddenly give that person the push they needed to actually do what they've been thinking about for so long, which is kill themselves. And this is why laws around the world were passed in the last decade to restrict the prescription of SSRI meds to older people, because it was finally admitted that a rash of child suicides had been associated with the use of these drugs. But they had the information decades before. They knew about it before. But it finally became so public, it was so obvious that that it did, in fact, change the rules. But it's still only, I think, the age cutoff is quite young. The problem remains. It's a very, very token kind of change to the way these medications are prescribed. But the point to take from this is that lowering inhibitions can lead to all kinds of consequences. Now, some of them which are positive, but often superficially positive, because it's a chemical effect. It's not an effect that derives from you having evolved in your person, in your understanding, in your self-development, your personal development. It's just a reversible chemical effect, and it's blunt. So when we see these killing rampages that occur, whether it's just individuals going loopy, or whether it's terrorist attacks, and we see that that is associated with the consumption of these types of drugs, I suggest that there is something serious going on here, that powers that be know what these drugs can do and are using it deliberately to create mind-controlled mass killers. But again, that's a topic for another show. I'd like to play to you now a clip from Kevin Miller talking about his film. This is from last year. And it's just an interesting little speech he gave at a conference. And it goes into some of the details of one of the letters he received from one of the respondents who formed part of the film.
I mean, I'm featuring human stories because I figured that at the very least, a lot of you here seeking information that we can learn through the eyes of our neighbors. And maybe if we don't learn from a doctor or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or from a teacher or a cop or anything else, we can learn because we have been touched by the stories of our neighbors. And so, you know, this is one letter, very brief, that I'm going to read to you. This is the whole reason why I've put myself back out here to produce another film on this topic, and it will be my last. Hi, Kevin. I just saw the documentary Generation RX, and I wanted to say thank you for making it. This is the first time I've heard that some people oppose medicating children. I was medicated starting at the age of 10 for anxiety and insomnia starting in 1996. I was on Paxil, Wellbutrin, Effexor, and Ambien by the time I was 15. The side effects were so severe that I became psychotic, hallucinating, shaking, not sleeping for days at a time, and paranoid that inanimate objects wanted to kill me. My mother finally weaned me off the meds against doctor's orders, who wanted to counter the side effects with more drugs. And like magic, I was fine. I felt abused and angry when I realized the ignorance and hypocrisy of these psychiatrists. I was told my brain was broken when I was a child and that the drugs were the only way to fix me. I spent puberty in a medicated stupor. I don't remember half of those years, and I will never get them back. I don't feel so alone after seeing your documentary. I now know there are people like you that fight for a child's right to their own mind. a right that was stripped from me. So again, thank you. This film helps heal some old wounds. Good luck on your endeavors, Brianna. So I guess the message I'll leave you with is that, you know, we need to return to this pre-Duchesne era of 1993. And many of you don't know what that means, but what it means is that's when we came together to fight for what I have termed medical freedom of choice. And medical freedom of choice is vital because it's not the extreme position of trying to ban Prozac or ban Risperdal or even Ritalin. It's not coming from that position. But what happened, and really quite magically, in 1993 and 94 when we passed Duchesne, was we had people come together across political differences, socioeconomic differences, religious, racial. Everyone came together because common sense dictated that we didn't want the pharmaceutical companies being in charge of our health. And so we put all the political differences and all of the differences known to man aside and put shoulder to shoulder together and created truly meaningful change. I mean, if that law would not have passed in 1994, it'd be game over. And so here in this era of faux news, I think it's more important than ever that we shelve some of the political nonsense and realize that in our commonality, that our neighbors need us to spread responsible information and to keep medical freedom of choice alive.
That's just a little speech there by Kevin Miller. I just want to briefly expand on the concept of freedom of choice, because in the film, towards the end, some of the people in it describe, and Kevin Miller goes into a great deal of depth in it, an alternative approach to dealing with depression, which is a new type of kind of a vitamin supplement technology called micronutrients. Now, I don't know too much about it, and I only first discovered it really watching this film. I mean, they're not just standard vitamins. They're vitamins in a particular form and a particular mix of vitamins and minerals, which are then ingested in liquid form. But a number of people in the film describe the effect that these alternate treatments have had, completely lifting their sense of hopelessness. It appears that a lot of the problems that people do experience with depression are due to a lack of certain essential vitamins and nutrients, especially in the brain. And of course, this is never going to be the 100% of the cause or the fix, because we all know that there are real reasons why people get upset. There are real reasons why people get sad. There are real reasons, especially in today's world, why people feel down, right? And that must never be negated. However, this alternate form of treatment looks really, really interesting. And it's also very interesting that Health Canada, where this started, Health Canada being a government organization, went to such efforts to suppress this and to actually have these vitamins banned. I mean, they're just vitamins. They tried to get them banned. They did police raids with drawn guns to try and prevent these things from being used. And of course, this is clearly at the behest of the drug industry, because it cuts into their market. This is just a mafia tactic to knock out the competition. But after many lawsuits and spending a lot of money, that they've basically established that these are now viable alternate treatments and can no longer be opposed in Canada. So this is something I'm going to get Kevin Miller on the show, hopefully, and we'll go into more detail about that, because understanding the connection between your mental health and your general health is something a lot of people don't really quite grasp. We're going to break. Stay with us, you're with Truth News Radio.
in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? And at that point...
Hi, welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. Now, I want to run through a few stories quickly here before the end of the hour. One story that came up just recently is in relation to banking bail-ins. I've got an article from Op-Ed News. A crisis worse than ISIS, bail-ins begin. Now, of course, bail-ins, something that we've discussed on the show a number of times, are the kind of the inverse of bail-outs, where the government underwrites banks to stop them collapsing. In bail-ins, it's actually the bank's creditors, including depositors, who actually lose their money, their savings in many cases, in order to save the banks. This is an article by Ellen Brown. While the mainstream media focus on ISIS extremists, a threat that has gone virtually unreported is that your life savings could be wiped out in a massive derivatives collapse. Bank bail-ins have begun in Europe, and the infrastructure is in place in the US. At the end of November, an Italian pensioner hanged himself after his entire 100,000 euro savings were confiscated in a bank rescue scheme. He left a suicide note blaming the bank where he had been a customer for 50 years and had invested in bank-issued bonds. But he might better have blamed the EU and the G20's Financial Stability Board, which have imposed an orderly resolution regime that keeps insolvent banks afloat by confiscating the savings of investors and depositors. Some 130,000 shareholders and junior bondholders suffered losses in the rescue. The Pensioners Bank was one of four small regional banks that had been put under special administration over the past 2 years. The 3.6 billion rescue plan launched by the Italian government uses a newly formed National Resolution Fund, which is fed by the country's healthy banks. But before the fund can be tapped, losses must be imposed on investors. And in January, EU rules will require that they also be imposed on depositors. According to a December 10th article on BBC.com, the rescue was a bail-in, meaning bondholders suffered losses, unlike the hugely unpopular bank bailouts during the 2008 financial crisis, which cost ordinary EU taxpayers tens of billions of euros. Correspondents say Italian Prime Minister Renzi acted quickly because in January the EU is tightening the rules on bank rescues. They will force losses on depositors holding more than 100,000 euros, as well as bank shareholders and bondholders. Letting the four banks fail under those new EU rules next year would have meant sacrificing the money of 1 million savers and the jobs of nearly 6,000 people. So this is something to be aware of, folks. The bail-ins are coming. Now, if you don't have a lot of money in the bank, you might be safe. And, of course, if you trust the deposit insurance, you may feel that you're safe because the deposit insurance, I think, protects Australians up to about $250,000. But there's something very important to understand about the deposit insurance scheme is that, and this is actually discussed in the article here, which I can't get into the detail because it's quite long, but in the US, the amount of money, the total amount of money that's available in that insurance scheme is less than one-tenth of the amount of money that is being insured in the forms of deposits. In other words, if there is a massive collapse, the insurance money is going to run out. The insurance companies themselves will go bankrupt. So a lot of people now, I think, are realizing that the system we've got, the way we make money, the way we keep money, the way we store it, is extremely vulnerable. And it is really now time to really think about other ways of protecting our wealth. So I'll just leave that with you, and I'll put that article up on our show notes. Now, I've got a couple of stories in relation to the erosion of democratic rights in Australia, and they're coming from very, very sober, mainstream conservative kind of sources that say to me that, you know, we really do have to face up to the fact now that Australia is becoming a police state. It's not like a police state anymore. It is a police state. I've got a video by Andrew Wilkie, independent MP, which is quite long and goes into a lot of detail, in which he describes Australia as a pre-police state. And, you know, Andrew Wilkie is a very sober, very conservative type person. And hearing him say these things is actually quite chilling, because it's not coming from the kind of angle of someone who's a fringe type person. It's coming from an angle of someone who's well within the establishment and is basically calling the alarm that our society is spiraling into a very, very dangerous type of scenario. And I've got another article here from George Williams, Professor of Law at the University of New South Wales. An extraordinary number of Australian laws now infringe basic democratic standards, but we hardly bat an eyelid. This year has borne out former Prime Minister Tony Abbott's prediction that for some time to come, the delicate balance between freedom and security may have to shift. Government agencies can now access the metadata of every person. Journalists can be jailed for reporting on matters of public interest, and Australians can be banished after having their citizenship revoked. This has led one Liberal MP, Andrew Nikolic, to suggest that the idea of protecting civil liberties in the context of national security has become redundant. Comments such as this reveal how far the coalition has travelled since it took office in 2013. As a new government, it cast itself as the champion of basic freedoms and lambasted restrictions on speech, such as Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. Any such pretensions have since been demolished by the government's own rhetoric and actions. It has moved on from Section 18C to introducing laws that jail people for up to a decade for disclosing information about intelligence operations that show a misuse of power. Now, that's a very interesting article. I'll just play to you a little from Andrew Wilkie's speech to Parliament as well, which touches on similar issues. Here we go.
Wait a second time, and I'll call the member for Denison.
Thank you, Deputy Speaker. Anything that diminishes the protection for the environment is obviously wrong and to be resisted, Deputy Speaker. So to deny some Australian citizens the right to access all aspects of the legal system, no matter what the matter is, or to deny some Australian citizens the right to judicial review in particular, is self-evidently wrong. In fact, anything that diminishes the protection of the environment, anything that diminishes the rights of our citizens, is so self-evidently wrong that it's quite remarkable that it's come before the Parliament and that we're even needing to debate the rights and wrongs of these issues. It is also wrong for us to look at these issues in isolation, because, Deputy Speaker, I suggest we need to take a step back at this point and have a look at the direction our country is going in a whole range of ways, and in particular the direction we're going about the rights of our citizens and the way in which the rights of our citizens and our groups, be it environmental groups or any other groups, are slowly being diminished in an incremental way. Because when you take a step back and you look at a whole range of decisions that have been made by this and previous governments, including the bill that's before the parliament today that would deny some Australian citizens the right to access all aspects of the legal system, you can draw a conclusion that Australia has reached the stage of being almost in a pre-police state, where the rights of citizens have been diminished so far, where the power of the state has increased so much, that we are in what I'll characterise as a pre-police state. Now, Deputy Speaker, when I turned my mind to this this issue today and to preparing this speech, it took me very little time to quickly come up with some 10 characteristics of a pre-police state which exist in Australia right now. And I'll quickly rattle through them, if you don't mind, Deputy Speaker. For a start, the way all members of the community are now monitored by the state on account of mandatory metadata retention, which passed this parliament some time ago, is already in law and will be implemented from next month. The community needs to understand that from next month, every phone call they make, every website they visit, every location signal sent from their mobile phone or other mobile device, electronic device, will be recorded by law and can be accessed by the security services without warrant. This is something that has been rejected by many other developed countries. The scale of the mandatory metadata retention, which is being implemented in this country from next month, is almost unprecedented around the world in any developed democracy, developed country or democracy. Another characteristic of a pre-police state, the way the media is being manipulated in this country.
We'll have to leave it there. I'll put the full video of Andrew Wilkie speaking to Parliament there on the website. It's been a great pleasure talking to you today, and I hope you've got some thoughts and ideas from what we've said. And do feel free to contact me via the website if you have any insights. Truth News Radio Australia signing out. We'll be back next week. See you then.